On average, trade buyers will pay more and a cleaner deal, but there's always going to be a change in culture. Your way of working is going to be different. There will be an impact on your people and just the DNA of your business, you know, and I think that is something to be very, very aware of. It doesn't necessarily mean you've got to be cautious at it. Some of these businesses are really experienced and do it really well, but do your homework. Welcome to episode 2 of the M&A Exit Lab. Great to have you with me. Yeah, it's an interesting one because I thought we would actually kick off with what can go catastrophically wrong with the deal. I think there's so much we could talk about to create a false sense of security around everything's great, rah-rah, and it's so easy to do a great deal. But I think you'll see after today's episode, there's some really interesting insights. And in many cases, unfortunately, in life, as we know, and it's no different in M&A, that the mistakes we made where we bump our heads, things go wrong, is where we take the material learnings. And I'm going to say, fortunately enough for our clients, you know, we've walked a very, very long journey with many, many deals, and some have gone really well and others haven't. And I think from those both sides of the coin, we've been able to determine what's, you know, what's good, what isn't good, and hopefully help some of you who are listening and watching this podcast to not make the same mistakes that other business owners have made or we have made in our own capacity. But what's interesting is this is what it's all about. I mean, this is unfortunately what they call a tombstone, but it's from a recent transaction we concluded that was announced in the press, and looking a little bit earlier in our boardroom, and there's 30 of the more recent deals that we've done, you realize that behind each one of these is there's a story, and not an easy one, and each one had its own challenges and landed in a specific place. And what I wanted to do today was really unpack deals that haven't gone according to plan, or what to look out for from, you know, a few different perspectives. And, you know, the starting one always is, you know, I think there's always this perception out there, and many guys do it, but from an advisor perspective, you know, when does the advisor walk away? You know, I think too often, and we've seen it in our market, and I know our colleagues around the world see it as well, where there's a lot of empty promises made by advisors to business owners. And I'm not going to say guarantees, but guarantees implied that this is going to work out well and everything's going to be hunky-dory, but in real terms, it doesn't necessarily play out. So yeah, I think the four areas I want to unpack just to give a bit of structure to this episode. The first one being, when did we as deal leaders walk away from a specific deal? And obviously I'm going to keep names confidential because that's a big part of what we do. The second one is really around, when did the client's ego or emotions get in the way, and what did that do to a deal? The third one is really around the risks of post-deal integration. We often assume that once a deal's done, it's all great. And then what happens after that? And then the last insight is really around kind of where that clash happens between culture and synergy. And I think we often underestimate, you know, the qualitative elements of a deal. And you'll see there's a big theme in the way I approach deal making and my focus and experience in getting deals across the line is very much a human-centric approach because, you know, people work with people and we can have all the tools and the insights and now we have the AI and the frameworks and experience. But at the end of the day, it does come down to that human dynamic, which is really important. And then to end off the episode, I really want to give you, for those of you that have received one or in the process of receiving a letter of intent, a non-binding offer, just some insights from my experience around, you know, what should be included, what to look out for, and any potential red flags. So I've got my cup of coffee. Let's get cracking. And I want to tackle that first part of the episode. So we've had a number of deals over the years, and I've had them personally where something happens during the process. Generally, it's before we approach the market, where we pick up something and we actually walk away. And I think we are working with business owners that operate within integrity. And most importantly, their numbers are, you know, and the way that they operate is compliant with the legislative and compliance environment. It's never that easy. And, you know, I think particularly if I think about our track record recently versus the early days, we've made, you know, some mistakes along the way, but we learned very quickly on what to look out for. And I think in this one particular case, what had come out was we were actually in the due diligence already. We had done a whole lot of work. And again, I suppose similar to an audit, as an outsider and advisor, even though you work really hard to get into the inner sanctum, you are reliant on management and management's ability to share the right level of information. And something came out during the due diligence, actually, where the compliance with payroll taxes, you know, something had not been done properly when it came to the sales team and commission and the likes. And for some reason, yeah, it had been missed by the auditors and it had been intentionally hidden. And that in itself is a big issue. You know, I think in a normal analytical review, data analysis, returns to the revenue services and the likes, everything looked fine. But this obviously popped up a big red flag and we couldn't be associated with that. And I think really it's about not making anybody wrong. Things happen, oversights happen. But I think when it comes down to something being intentional, then there's an issue that we can't move forward with. And I think for anybody out there, whether it's with a buyer, if you are the business owner, something happens in, you know, internally, or you're working with, you know, advisors that don't tick all those boxes. We, you know, it was a tough one because we'd walked a long journey and we definitely lost a lot of money through our time and effort invested in that. But, you know, at a brand level, and as an advisor, we didn't want to be associated with that. And we would come across that acquirer again in the marketplace. And the deal fell over, you know, I think for obvious reasons. And I think what we work really hard on is in that trusted advisor role to tell our clients, just be open and honest. Because whatever it is, if it's disclosed, it can be dealt with. And, you know, we've had numerous occasions where maybe it's ignorance, lack of experience, where things are treated in a certain way and it wasn't handled properly. But we've been part of the solution. You know, we've worked with the client, with the relevant authorities and make sure that they get everything sorted and get their ducks in a row. And I think, you know, this theme particularly, whether it's that one example or not, and it was resolved. I mean, I think, you know, I heard after the fact that it had been resolved with the authorities and all of that and the client decided not to sell. But it was a big lesson, and I think an expensive lesson and a reputational lesson for that business and for us as well. You know, I think we took, you know, big learnings out of that. But it goes back and you'll see there's some common themes that are going to come through this series. And as we delve deeper and deeper, and I think one of them is really around preparation and giving yourself enough time. Because I think, you know, when you go through this process, you prepare whatever you're going to do because of a transaction. It's the first time there's a sense check based on what the market is looking for and how it gets approached. In many cases, our clients are being acquired by private equity firms, large corporates, listed entities, international entities. And one always needs to remember that that's going to come with a very different level of scrutiny. So make sure that those elements are sorted. And I think that's an important, you know, example, I guess. I think there was another example a little more recently where we actually advised our client to walk away from the acquirer. And there were, you know, there was a host of reasons. And I think it had shown up around how the deal structure was approached. And initially, you know, everything was aligned and it definitely made sense. But, you know, we had a deal where it was actually around COVID time. And the company performance up until that point, it had been at a certain level. But because of COVID, the numbers had dropped a little bit. And the way to mitigate that, because our client was obviously very confident that the numbers would recover, a structure was put in place whereby 60% would have been paid on day one. And then the balance would have been paid a year later based on the recovery of that profit number. And up to that point, we'd said, look, this is a long-term investment. And if we had a situation where the recovery wasn't full and back to pre-COVID levels, if it was said 80 or 90% of what their profit number needed to be, could there be a pro rata payment? So it wasn't an all or nothing. And the initial feedback was, yes, that's good. So we went to try and bake that into the agreement. Literally 2 days later, had a follow-up conversation with the acquirer and they'd done a 180. They'd said that, no, they've changed their mind. It was pretty much an all or nothing. So the risk there, and it was obviously the first positioning that we put back in the acquirer's court was, well, if you are a client, would you sell your business for 60% of the value? Because if the number was 95% of what it needed to be, you're pretty much going to get nothing. And it was at that point we realized that, again, kind of a different side of the coin here, but there was a potential integrity issue there. And thank goodness we went back to our client and said, look, you may back yourself, but, you know, in a situation like this, it's not worth the risk. And our client walked away based on our recommendation. And it turns out 2 years later, that acquirer was gone. had gone under and some, you know, other shenanigans had come out. And it was quite interesting because we do due diligence on acquirers and people we work with, and they'd come with strong pedigree, you know, coming from some of the top investment banks in South Africa. So the track record was there, you know, they were spoken highly of. And this one little thing came out and you just realize, well, who are we actually dealing with and how's that going to show up post-deal? And I think that's often the case. I always say that a great litmus test is always to see how your potential partner, be it the buyer or the seller and vice versa, how they handle the actual negotiation and the deal closeout process. Because if it's constructive, yes, it could be heated and, it's not always going to be plain sailing. But it's important because if it's constructive, done in integrity, it sets a platform around how you're going to work together as partners. So that's an important one. And never great to go through processes like this. And the irony is that company did recover, where it's actually in market now. And it's significantly stronger than it was back then. So interesting how things work out. Not great at the time. Exhausting for the business owner. Because you got the highs and lows and you know, for him, it was the first proper due diligence. So that in itself was a tough experience, but they grew stronger out of it. So yeah, all round, I think in both directions, both of those deals taught us a lot and probably worked out better for the business owner. Moving on to the second one, which is always the killer, and that's the good old ego, you know, and I think it's very difficult for business owners, particularly those business owners that build a very successful business that generates a lot of profits, high yields in dividends, and by everyone's definition is very, very successful. Because what happens in those situations, in many cases, is the ego gets in and there's a disconnect between what the business owner wants and thinks, particularly around valuation and how good their business is and whatever that may be and where the market gets positioned. And that's really difficult because an ego, I think, you know, most A-type personalities, entrepreneurs have to have that level of, I want to say, balance between ego and confidence. But again, that has to align with certainty and clarity. And you would have heard in the previous episode that this thing around clarity being a currency is really important because what do buyers want? You know, I use the same analogy with South Africa, is what do foreign investors want? They just want certainty, you know, whether it's this policy or that policy or not, they just want to be able to price for the risk. And I think that's where buyers need to get a degree of comfort. And the one area always is around valuation, you know, and I think it's for any business owner out there, I think it's really important to spend your time to truly understand how the market will value your business and what that looks like. Not saying that there won't be an outlier and you'll get great premium, but it's really to calibrate what that's going to look like because I've seen many, many deals almost fall over because there's a sense of greed that comes in, you know, towards the end. And everything that had been agreed up front is now, you know, the goalposts are moving. And it goes down to that concern that is often raised by acquirers that if you move in the goalposts now, what is our partnership going to be like post-transaction? So in this particular example, we had a very, very successful business and we actually secured a very good offer out of a listed investment holding group. So we did a lot of work. The price expectation was reasonable when we embarked on the journey and it just kept moving north. I think what didn't help the cause was the company was doing really well and the outlook was very positive. But it became quite difficult to keep up. And there was this ebb and flow with, there were two shareholders with their egos, one particularly. So we did get to the point where we could get the deal value aligned. It was a really, really good deal. The buyer came in. It was all cash. There was no debt in the deal. It was all up front. And it was at a very, very good multiple. So box ticked in our mind and alignment with the shareholders. And they formally accepted the offer. So that we were about to move into the next phase. And as part of our engagement with the clients up front, and it's something that Deal Leaders does, is we did a piece of almost management consulting work prior to going to market to unpack the growth opportunities and how could this business essentially be taken to, sorry, I use the term the next level, whatever that means. But in this case was to, you know, how to get 30, 40, 50% growth over the next 3 years. Because it's something that buyers would look to if they weren't coming from the same industry. So we did this, I'm going to say, strategic exit readiness assessment and came up with some really good insights and strategic directions that they could take. And we used those as part of the selling points, if you like, to with this particular buyer who put this great offer forward. And just post the offer acceptance, this good old thing called greed kicked in. And this one shareholder particularly just decided that it was time. You know, they thought, no, you know what? They can actually do it all themselves while they're selling for such a low number. And, you know, it involved with destroying almost a strategic relationship in another part of the country that had been there a long time. And they did a 180, and it wasn't great. I think from the buyer's perspective, it was probably a relief, because if that's how they behaved, you know, at that stage, then, you know, how would it play out a little bit later? But never easy. And I think that it's hard and difficult for me to sit here and speak to a business owner and say, like, you know, don't let your ego get in the way and have realistic value expectations and all of those elements. And I always, it's about how that unfolds and how the work's done and how we can give insights and almost educate business owners and buyers on the other side around how the other party's feeling and how they value it and where they see the issues and all of those sort of components. So, you know, it's quite interesting. I think it's like anything, where until such time as there's an actual written offer in front of a business owner, you don't really know how you're going to react, what the process is going to look like. And yeah, I think from that element, something to be cognizant of, you know, always. And you know, in this case, it was unfortunate. And let's see what happens. And it'll be interesting to see how their 180 on that ability, I guess, to do it all themselves versus using the right strategic partner to hit those growth trajectories and the likes, then you know, time will tell. So we'll see how it plays out from there. The third element, you know, and it's an important one that I wanted to unpack, is, you know, post-transaction integration. And it's quite interesting that this comes up, because we're actually dealing with one right now. So we did a good deal that was finalized beginning of last year, actually, 2024. And classic case where we had a father and son built up a great business over 25, 30 years. And it was a niche play, had a very unique skill set. And when we went to market, a large European entity with a South African presence was attracted to the business, because this business had specific skill sets, clients, and a way of doing their work in a specific way that this large European business couldn't. There was a great synergistic fit. You know, the European operator sat in the slightly bigger projects, and our client could handle the smaller jobbing stuff. And all seemed good. Again, you know, good deal, clean, quite a, I'm going to say, a light due diligence from the acquirer's perspective. But, you know, often when there's a trade player, they're looking for something specific. And I think it was, you know, it was people and it was customers. So everything happened. And then there was, you know, the transaction went through. And then this smaller entity, literally on day one, was rebranded. It was rebranded under the mother brand of this European business. And from that day, the business started deteriorating, and our client stayed on for what was supposed to be a year, actually, you know, exited a little bit earlier. And both sides were frustrated because it was very different. And ironically, the very, I'm going to say, uniqueness and USP of our client's business that drove the acquirer to buy that business was being undone by the acquirer because they thought they could do it better. The entrepreneurial DNA and fit of our client's business was being lost because it was swallowed up into this large corporate. So it was a really, really sad story, because I think a lot of the best people from our client's business ended up leaving, and, you know, it kind of landed in a very, very messy place. And I think that's often the trade-off. You know, I think you've got to do your homework. And the homework had been done, which was quite interesting, because this acquirer had done it before with other businesses and the integration had supposedly been successful. But in this case, it just didn't play out the right way. And it becomes messy when there's an earnout structure. In this one, there was a small piece of that, which is now in dispute. And it becomes he said, she said. And I think the owners always reside with the buyer, I would think, because the due diligence was not done comprehensively enough. I mean, everything was disclosed. We did significant work with the client to clean up their numbers, present them well, make the due diligence as seamless as possible. But it still landed in a bad place. And it's very easy after the fact to be able to, you know, point fingers and try lay blame on someone, but the damage has already been done. So really not great to see. You know, I must say in my career in M&A, it's only the second time I've seen that happen. So it's a very, very low chance of it happening. And it's unfortunate, you know. And I think, you know, I went back and I think to myself, could we have done something differently? Very difficult to say. So you know, I don't think we could have picked it up. And we always encourage our clients to speak to other companies that were acquired by this acquirer and that was positive. So in the absence of that, very, very difficult. But it's all about checks and balances. And, you know, it will unfortunately happen again. Luckily, the majority of the purchase price was paid. Our clients out of there. And now that acquirer needs to see what they can do with this business. But never, never great. And a tough one, you know, because you put in so much time, but the time we put in as the advisor is really small versus how much time and effort was invested in that business, in its people. And, you know, that legacy has been tarnished, which is not ideal. But, you know, we're still on great speaking terms with our clients. And, you know, this is something that's going to need to unfold in time. And their chapter on that one is closed. So they'll need to move on to the next chapter and see what happens from there. Then lastly, the last point I wanted to chat about is really this balance, I guess, between culture and synergy. And I can almost dovetail back to the previous example I gave, because there was very obvious synergy in that situation, but there was a clash of culture. And it's not really another example I want to give, although I've got another one where the ego was actually with the buyer. And it was a classic case of that buyer coming in and thinking he could do it better. He was half the age of our client at the time, and they just came in and they just tried to change absolutely everything, and they smashed that business. And again, luckily enough, you know, it was a relatively clean deal. So financially, it didn't have a big impact on a client, but it did have a big impact on their legacy and what they left behind, which was unfortunate to know. And we've never touched that acquirer again. But again, good pedigree. And what showed up initially in negotiations was actually really positive. The due diligence, all of that was good. And then as soon as the deal was done, this Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde scenario popped out. So very unpleasant. We obviously helped our client get out of that. And you know, that business was swallowed up into a larger one. So probably the theme I wanted to position with business owners to be very cognizant of is when we look at buyers, there's two categories. There's your financial buyer. So that could be investment holding companies or private equity companies, or there could be an industry or trade buyer, which is similar to the examples I've just given now. And, you know, we've seen many cases that on average, trade buyers will pay more and a cleaner deal. So financially, it can tick those boxes, but there's always going to be a change in culture. The way your way of working is going to be different. There will be an impact on your people and just the DNA of your business, you know, and I think that is something to be very, very aware of. It doesn't necessarily mean you've got to be cautious at it. Some of these businesses are really experienced and do it really well, but do your homework, you know, and I think from that perspective, also always measure the blowout risk. And I'm not a glass half empty person, but always think about worst case scenario. If this doesn't work out, what does the deal look like for you? What outs and options do you have? Because the synergies could be great, and those synergies could be this acquirer is going to come in, buy my business, and I've got a real upside. Yes, that is true. But what happens if those synergies don't materialize? What does the downside look like? On the flip side, from a category of buyer would be your financial buyers. And in most cases, those financial buyers won't necessarily buy 100% of the business, which means they would require you to stay on for, you know, whatever that period looks like as a shareholder. And in most cases, they won't impact the way you work, that, you know, the very DNA and ways of working and whatever culture you've built. They generally want to back you, and they want to back that recipe of success, if you like. So that's an important consideration when, you know, if you've got more than one buyer at the table, to look at the pros and cons, because I always say it's effective day plus one. What does it look like the day after the deal when you as the business owner come to work and either you've got a new boss or you've got a new partner? What happens? What happens to you? What happens to your people? Because I think in most cases, business owners who've built these businesses and founders over the years, your team are like your family. They've been there a long time. They are part of the very success that you've sold to an acquirer. And what's going to happen to them? They unfortunately don't have necessarily the financial reward that the founder would have. But it's something to be very cognizant of and to factor that into your own strategy. So yeah, look, I mean, those are four examples. And again, it's not my style to go into the negative, but you know, I did commit up front in this podcast that it's going to be a warts and all sort of scenario. And those are some just very high level examples. And I'm sure we'll go into some more unpacking what works, what doesn't work. And in these cases, you know, four different scenarios that played out into not so great results. But hopefully that, you know, always say like forewarned is forearmed. So hopefully that gives you some more tools in your toolbox and some more elements to be aware of, you know, when embarking on this journey, if you are in that phase. And if you are in that phase and there's an interested party at the table and they're going to be submitting a letter of intent or a non-binding offer, whatever that looks like, you know, there's some key elements that I always recommend must be in those documents, because although these days they may not be binding and some maybe, some won't be, they'll always be subject to a due diligence, they still go through quite a rigid approval process. And, you know, although there's always going to be a degree of risk based on what they find in due diligence, the more detail you can put into that non-binding offer or letter of intent, the better, because it forces that acquirer to think through a lot. And I think the starting point always is, what are they buying? And it sounds quite straightforward, but if you've got a holding structure or multiple entities, what does that look like? And real clarity around the organizational structure and what is it that they're buying. And the second one would be around, you know, what is the value? And is the value fixed, or is there a formula? Is there an earnout structure or whatever it is? And that's got to be, you know, I was chatting to someone a while back and they were talking about how they write a letter or whatever it may be, communication. And they said, always aim it at a grade 9 or 10 level. And I always say, if a grade 9 or 10 read it, they need to pretty much understand how it works. So keep it simple, you know, in black and white. If you were to give it to somebody cold and they looked at this, the structure would make sense. If there's a formula or anything funny from their perspective, try to get as much clarity as possible, because you don't want to leave the opportunity open for that price to be discounted because of, you know, complications or change of heart or whatever it may be. And then linked to that structure is, how does the payment and, you know, and the funding work relative to that structure? Is it all on day one? Is there an earnout? What does that mean? And if they need to go and raise funding, which we see particularly, you know, from a private equity perspective, where there's some of their own cash and some of it is debt to optimize their returns, where are they raising debt from? You know, do they have a track record for raising debt? Who are the funders? You know, try and get a lot of clarity there, because what's important on that one is the funders, if they are putting debt behind the acquirer, they're going to have a big say on the valuation. So if a offer is put forward by an acquirer subject to funding, be very careful on that, because just because a value has been put forward, that term subject to funding means it could change based on what funding is available. So that's something to be, you know, really, really careful of. I think another one would be key expectations of you. How long do they expect you to stay on? And something I've learned over the years is, often it's time. I need you to stay on for 3 years. What does that mean? You know, what needs to be achieved in those 3 years? Is it to find a successor, to open up a new channel, new market, whatever that may be? So it's quite good to have both. You know, it's a period as well as specific. So if you can close that out quicker, then hopefully there's an option for you to leave early if you want to, because yeah, if it's just left at 3 years, you know, it's quite generic. Also, what's important linked to that is, if you have an earnout structure or something like that, try and make sure that that structure is aligned to the period that you're staying in. Because if there is a period that you're not there and there's an upside to your deal value, or there's a part payment or whatever it may be, just be aware that you won't be in the business and you won't be in control. So that could have a negative impact, you know, so be cognizant of those risks. I would then also look at elements around your people, commitments to make sure that they aren't going to be widespread job cuts or restructurings in a specific period of time. And look, business prevails, so things change and whatever it may be, but it's just to give your team comfort from that perspective. And then also, how's it going to be communicated? I think that's, you know, one of those other elements. And yeah, look, there's probably quite a few more, but I'd say those are probably the most common ones I can think of. If there's any others in subsequent conversations we have, you know, and particularly when we look at from a buyer perspective, we can get their insights in what they're like putting forward and what they want to see. So yeah, that's it. That's a wrap on this episode. I hope you found it insightful. Like I said, I think we'll just keep evolving and hopefully get a little bit more polished as we progress. But yeah, keen to get your feedback and comments, and particularly what I've raised here. Any of you that have had specific experiences like that, I'm always intrigued to see what happened and what learnings, you know, can be taken out of that. But yeah, again, thanks for your time. Thanks for walking this journey, and hopefully you took some pearls of wisdom out of this one. See you again next episode. Cheers.